Nowhere in the pages of history can one find a greater champion of justice. Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear.
And I'll tell you something else, too, is I cannot stand sissies.
You're going to talk about wrestling, that's redneck talk.
And guess what, Fatso? I'm the world champion.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to When It Was Cool Wrestling, the Dragon King Carl Classic Wrestling audio show. I'm Carl Stern, your host. Thank you very much for joining me in our rotation of classic wrestling shows where we discuss wrestling history in detail and in depth. We are around to our From the Pages of the Wrestling Observer newsletter series, where I revisit biographies, obituaries, wrestling history pieces as written by Dave Meltzer in the Pages of the Wrestling Observer newsletter. I almost didn't do this show today on Jim Wilson, his obituary biography from February 18th, 2009, because I know Jim Wilson was not exactly a huge star in pro wrestling history, but I think he's a very, very interesting personality. Many people had, again, think about the time frame here. He passed away in 2009, and several years before this, if my memory serves me correct, it was around 1999 or 2000, 2001, somewhere in there, a book came out called Chokehold, and it was written by Jim Wilson and I think Weldon Johnson. It was a very in-depth, super deeply researched book from a former professional wrestler, an expose on the pro wrestling business. Now, back then, this was, again, early days of the internet. Things, newspapers.com wasn't yet a thing. There was really wrestling history on the internet. It was only beginning to be really hashed out. And so you couldn't just do a, you know, newspapers.com search for Jim Wilson or something. It was, wrestling historians were dealing largely on their memory. YouTube was just, you know, coming into its own. There wasn't the proliferation of footage available back then. And so many people had no idea who Jim Wilson was, aside from his very kind of bizarre appearance on 2020. The same show where Dr. D. David Schultz had slapped John Stossel. There was a segment on there with involving Jim Wilson, again talking about the dark underbelly of professional wrestling. Many people may remember Eddie Mansfield on there because he bladed and stuff, but Jim Wilson was also on there too, though not as popularly remembered. And really, a lot of even well-studied historians didn't really remember Jim Wilson that much, although it did seem like legitimately he had been a wrestler during the territorial days. By now, a lot of footage has come up. You can go to YouTube and watch multiple Jim Wilson matches and his appearance, of course, on the 2020 and later the Morton Downey Jr. show and so forth. But when Chokehold came out, it was this very obscure wrestler doing a very, very well-researched, in-depth expose of pro wrestling. And so it was a super divisive book. I remember reading the book myself and really thinking, just being impressed with the amount of research that went into it. And at that time, I was doing, really, I mean, this was the days before the iPod even existed, so they weren't called podcasts, but over at Dragon King Press Newsletter, we were doing internet audio. We were recording audio and putting it up on our website even way back then, and I was interviewing a number of people involved in the wrestling business. And so once I read this book, I was very impressed by it, and I reached out to both Jim Wilson and Weldon Johnson about appearing on our show to discuss it. And got back very cordial responses, and we set up a date and set up the time to do it. I sent them a list of, you know, some of the things I'd like to discuss on there, and they sent back a response saying, oh yeah, that's wonderful, we would like to discuss these things here. And they sent a list, and so it looked great. And then, like the day before the show, I get this unhinged email from I believe it was from Weldon Johnson, just like accusing us of all sorts of stuff. And I'm thinking to myself, you undoubtedly are confusing us with somebody else, because I have no clue what you're talking about. But it was just a complete, and then that's when I realized, I was dealing with some people that were maybe a little bit outside the norm, and the interview never happened. I was like, look, I'm not even going to attempt to interview this guy. He seems kind of out there a little bit, at least his manager or co-author or whatever. Just didn't sit well with me, so I ended up never recording the interview. But the book, as it turns out, the book has its fans and it has its detractors. There are a lot of people that have said the book is riddled with errors. And certainly, I would say it is a... Jim Wilson thought very highly of himself. Let's put it that way. Now, he was a great college football player, to make no mistake. And look, great athletes and entertainers should have a lot of confidence. For the degree of celebrity that Jim Wilson actually was, perhaps he went a little bit too far. We'll see. Let's see what Dave has to say once Jim Wilson had passed away back in 2009. This is from the pages of the Wrestling Observer newsletter. Dave says, if you looked at his career inside the ring, Jim Wilson would be considered little more than a trivial name in wrestling annals. A former All-American college football player who had an undistinguished NFL career, he was recruited into the sport and teased with future stardom. But reality was, Jim Wilson was a poor performer and got a reputation as a complainer or a clubhouse lawyer. If he was a money draw, his reputation would have been as a stand-up guy, as that's the difference in perception. But since he wasn't, he was never a major star and ended up being far better known after his career was over for vocally complaining about the system. Wilson passed away from cancer on February 2, 2009, at the age of 67. He spent years talking with congressmen trying to get pro wrestling regulated in Georgia, ultimately being blocked at every turn by the wrestling establishment. He lived out his life believing his chances of success in both wrestling and life were destroyed at every turn by his arch nemesis, legendary wrestling promoter Jim Barnett. He blamed Barnett for his career in the ring going south, losing non-wrestling jobs, and many of the things in his life went badly. He claimed that by turning down a sexual advance from Barnett, a well-known homosexual promoter, while on a tour of Australia, it took him out of line from winning the NWA World Heavyweight Championship, a viewpoint almost nobody would agree with. Wilson was definitely looked at when he first started by the NWA power brokers, but by the time he toured Australia, he had already garnered a reputation for being a completely forgettable wrestler, and in no way, based on his bookings by that time, did it appear anyone saw him as superstar material. He also blamed Barnett for destroying his career with the NWA and eventually being blacklisted. He blamed Barnett when his own attempts to start a wrestling company in competition with the NWA failed, and certainly Barnett, his competitor, would have been a major factor in screwing with him at every turn in those attempts. And he would blame the power of Barnett and Ted Turner for getting to the state's politicians whenever he would get a supporter to introduce a bill to regulate wrestling, which was undoubtedly true. He was the subject of numerous media stories on problems in wrestling, wrestlers being underpaid based on the revenue they drew, not having a union, being told to cut their foreheads with razor blades, and being abused and spit on. In Georgia, he had credibility with some of the media, particularly those who remembered him as legendary football coach Vince Dooley's first All-American at the University of Georgia. He, at times, after nobody in the NWA would use him and between independent runs, would go to matches and make sure people there knew he was there, even though he was not part of the show. He would go to NWA shows and pass out flyers in the parking lot for his opposition events, to the chagrin on the NWA side. He even, for a time, picketed shows, garnering area publicity for all those things. He sued the National Wrestling Alliance twice and was well known as a thorn in the side of Jim Barnett. He co-wrote a book with Weldon T. Johnson, a Chicago sociologist who taught criminology and sociology at several universities, called Chokehold. in 2003. It was part autobiography and part very important historical look at the formation and power period of the National Wrestling Alliance, complete with previously unpublished finds of a U.S. Justice Department investigation of the industry in the 1950s. The autobiography was generally criticized as him overstating his case as a wrestling star, but the book was valuable in publicly revealing previously sealed reports from an investigation of the NWA, plus information learned from discovery in his own lawsuits against Georgia Championship Wrestling. It also contained his personal knowledge of so many behind-closed-doors aspects of the stock maneuverings as well as dirty tactics of the famous Georgia Wrestling War of 1972 through 1974. Jim Wilson had few allies in his fight to do things like starting a union and getting wrestling regulated. And his battles with Barnett and Georgia Championship Wrestling became an obsession. The struggle cost him his home and his family. And later in life, in his book, he noted one of the reasons he wrote the book, which he never expected to make money with, was to explain to his six children why things went as they did. In some ways, he was on the side of right in an industry where that made you wrong. Whether he understood it or not, the wrestlers of that era, for the most part, like today, didn't want to buck the system and risk their careers by starting a union, even though virtually all wished there was such a thing in place after their careers were over, when they struggled, often with no job skills, while their contemporaries in baseball, football, and basketball, while not having it great, did have it substantially better. Jim Wilson, spending several years in the NFL, couldn't come to grips with the difference, seeing wrestlers as overall underpaid, and had seen the positives of the work the NFL players had done in the battle to be unionized, even though the NFL union for years was criticized as being weaker than the baseball union, and thus there was a lower salary structure, even though football was the more popular of the two sports. But even those who could see the future simply didn't see Wilson as the guy they wanted to lead their promotion. But his detractors would note that he overstated his case, and as his public story of being blackballed out of the business for refusing sexual relations with Barnett sounded suspicious to many, since Barnett did have a business reputation for not mixing business with pleasure. All the wild stories about Barnett's life that Wilson recounted, which sounded exaggerated, were similarly stated in a book about Barnett's dealings with a college football program in Kentucky when he ran a wrestling promotion out of that state. Privately, Barnett even bragged about them to a far greater degree to his few trusted close friends than even Wilson, his mortal enemy in life, wrote. Barnett denied the stories to everyone else and was still alive when Wilson and Ole Anderson's books came out. He claimed to have read neither, but was hurt more by it being written that he was gay than what it would take as far as more serious accusations about embezzling money, cheating on payoffs and taxes, swerving deception, and underhanded means described of his gaining and maintaining power in the industry. Barnett was always leery over his being outed as being gay, feeling people would look at him differently, even though everyone in wrestling was aware of it. But in that era, if you could draw money, you could find a place to work. In a business that was, in fact, racist in many places, Wilson claimed that the success of Bobo Brazil as the top African-American babyface star was because he was a good, quote, boy, as much a business term for workers as the racial implications some may see with the word, although the N-word was openly used as a business term for African-Americans by many promoters and wrestlers in that era. Bobo Brazil went along with the system and did well, but ultimately was still underpaid. Bobo Brazil's stardom in wrestling was not because he didn't complain, although that did make him more popular with promoters, but because nearly everywhere he went, he was a major drawing card. Ernie Ladd was hard for promoters to deal with, but he was one of the highest paid and most in-demand wrestlers in the business during his heyday. And it worked both ways. Promoters complained about Herb Bearcat Wright and Claude Thunderbolt Patterson, who both were charismatic and could draw, but often played the race card in battles with the NWA when they were out of the mainstream. Still, both were able to find regular work even after doing things that would have gotten a marginal wrestler tossed out of the business many times over. Bearcat Wright was actually the first African-American to win a major world title, capturing the WWA title in Los Angeles from Fred Blassie in 1963. Nearly three decades before wrestling history celebrates Ron Simmons with that distinction. Bearcat Wright was a tremendous drawing card for a hot period of area wrestling. When it came time to drop the title, Bearcat Wright continued to refuse to do so. Fred Blassie, who considered himself good friends with Wright, talked his way into getting the title that Wright continually refused to drop to Edouard Carpentier, who the office kept asking him to lose to. On December 13, 1963, Bearcat Wright agreed to lose the title to Fred Blassie. Blassie was weakened from being in the hospital with either broken ribs or coming off an appendicitis, and noticed Wright was forcibly working stiff with him, powering him around and not allowing him much offense. Then, as both men were fighting outside the ring, Wright, who had pro boxing experience, sucker-punched Blassie, knocking him out. He climbed back in the ring. Blassie couldn't get back in, even with the ref counting as slow as possible, and the ref had no choice but to declare Wright the winner by countout. The end of the story was that a few days later, and this is one of the more famous stories in wrestling history, a rematch was booked and Wright was in the ring waiting for Blassie. Suddenly, to the ring came Gene LaBelle, the office shooter. Wright knew the score and left the ring with his belt, grabbed his things, didn't change, got in his car, and drove out of town. Gene LaBelle was declared the winner by forfeit, although on television it was announced that Carpentier, who the promotion wanted to win the title in the first place, was awarded the title when Wright no-showed a title defense. But the point is, after all that, Wright got regular work all over the world, usually on top, and a few years later even worked for Mike LaBelle. And by now, Mike LaBelle and Gene LaBelle were brothers, and the sons of longtime boxing and wrestling promoter Aileen Eaton, however Gene dropped the E in the spelling of his name, because that was the nature of the business when it came to someone who could draw. Also, the LaBelles, by the way, David didn't mention this, did not get along at all. Patterson through the years, Thunderbolt Patterson that being, through the years had similar problems, stemming from claiming he was flat out that it was because of his skin color. He would never be considered to be NWA World Champion. Thunderbolt Patterson was charismatic, to be sure, but there were others who were more charismatic. And the NWA in that era used a great worker who could have classic matches and had the ability to make the local stars look like world beaters, as well as carry themselves in the right way as champion. Patterson was never close to being that guy, as he was very limited as a worker, didn't bump much, and had to be carried by a great worker to have a good match. Plus, he was bitter because Dusty Rhodes used his stick to become a far bigger star than he ever was. He had refused to do a job when Terry Funk was world champion on a big show in Atlanta that had a monster house. Later, he went to California, but neither Roy Shire nor Mike LaBelle would hire him. This led to Thunderbolt Patterson, Wright, and Ron Pope, a.k.a. the Magnificent Zulu, who was a poor worker noted for having huge muscular arms and who had been working for Shire but didn't get over and was poorly paid. They joined forces to protest the treatment of African Americans by the two leading California promoters. They complained to both the NAACP and the California State Athletic Commission, and they got some media coverage. Most damaging was that testifying that wrestling was fake in the newspapers didn't help business. But even worse, their pressure caused, for a short period of time, the California State Athletic Commission to order an announcement that had to be said at the opening of every televised wrestling show. The following wrestling exhibitions are for entertainment purposes only. The winners and the losers have been selected in advance by the promoters. Wow, that is in fact pretty jarring. Dave continues, that incident was so strong that even though Patterson could draw, no promoter would touch him. At that point, Patterson was reduced to working as a night watchman and janitor in the offices of the Los Angeles Times. When Thunderbolt Patterson returned to Georgia, he couldn't get work in Barnett's promotion. He filed a complaint with the EEOC in the state. The EEOC, after speaking with Barnett, who listed a series of documented complaints against Patterson, including no showing a world title match before a big house because they wouldn't give him the title, and he was unreliable, caused trouble, and then blamed his problems on racism, the EEOC wouldn't proceed any further. Thunderbolt Patterson, who was Jim Wilson's tag team partner in the media, in lawsuits and in protesting, still was brought back over and over again in Georgia because he could draw, and to get him to stop his public protesting. And he had become some of the worst, there's a strange page break here. Patterson, who was Jim Wilson's tag team partner in the media, in the lawsuits and in protesting, still was brought back over and over in Georgia because he could draw, and to get him to stop his public protesting well into the mid-1980s when he could barely move, and his once vaunted interviews became some of the worst in the profession. And in the end, Thunderbolt Patterson was a strong catalyst behind the scenes in the lawsuit against WCW by Sonny Ono and a number of minority wrestlers that ended up costing Turner Broadcasting millions and making people like Ono, Hardbody Harrelson, and Bobby Walker rich men. Okay, pause right here, enter Carl Stern. I was involved in this lawsuit, full disclosure. I was a statistic gatherer for the law offices of Meadows, Ichter, and Trigg. These people did not become rich men. They got a substantial settlement divided amongst all of them, but none of them became rich off the settlement, the terms of which were sealed. I don't even know what they were, but I was told by the attorney at Meadows, Ichter, and Trigg, Kerry Ichter, that I can generally guess in the range of what it was, and none of these men become rich men from that settlement, despite what publicly has been said. I certainly didn't become a rich man from this lawsuit, nor was I expecting to be so. Nevertheless, Thunderbolt Patterson was absolutely very much involved in that. To continue Dave's biography here. In that case, it was true racial words were still being spoken by key people in a Turner-owned company. But the Turner side buckled because, on average, white wrestlers were being paid more than African-American wrestlers, and Harrison and Walker were never given a shot at being more than jobbers. Then again, few believed they had the ability to be any more than that. But that was a hard case to win in court when you had enough witnesses giving depositions about the major decision makers using racial slurs, because the wrestling from offices were often decades behind society when it comes to those type of subjects. In the end, the lawsuit led to Booker T getting multiple world title reigns in the dying days of the promotion, and brother Stevie Ray being all over television as a color commentator with contracts of $750,000 to $900,000 per year at a time when Ric Flair was only earning $500,000. When Wilson was in the media, on television, news reports, when he would state his case, he would come across like a wrestler doing a promo, and not necessarily a good one, which may have worked okay on Saturday mornings when he taped his interviews when he was a wrestler, but in the real world, it made him hard to be taken seriously. He already had a strike against him trying to talk about the condition of wrestlers, a group of people the media and public didn't take seriously. All right, we're going to take a mid-show break right here. When we come back, talk more about the life and death of very interesting, very intriguing, more so than his actual stardom might suggest, one Jim Wilson, right after this.
WhenItWasCool.com is your source for the best in retro pop culture. When It Was Cool features articles and podcasts on retro TV and movies, toys, action figures, pro wrestling, food, video games, and more. Hit the Patreon button to support us and get instant access to hundreds of premium podcasts and features. Family friendly and fun. WhenItWasCool.com.
Dave continues in the pages of the Wrestling Observer newsletter. Perhaps he truly believed the Barnett story on why he was never the star that, say, Wahoo McDaniel, who had a similar football background, was, although there were better football players than he was who, for a variety of reasons, also never made it in wrestling. Perhaps he used it as a crutch for the fact his career in wrestling wasn't successful, even though he was a better athlete than most in the profession at the time. and his reputation for balking at doing jobs and an outright refusal to blade may have really been what killed his NWA career. While big stars in that era got away with both, he acted like he was a big star who should have been put over in the main events. But those who saw him in that time frame never saw him as anything but a marginal at best talent. Having seen him wrestle numerous times in that era, the best way to describe him was a guy who was totally forgettable. A well below average worker with no special charisma whose only claim to fame is that he had a real football credential. Jim Wilson was a first-team All-American as an offensive tackle on the legendary coach Vince Dooley's first year at the helm of the Georgia Bulldogs in 1964. Even though college football had gone to the two-platoon system that players didn't play on both offense and defense years earlier, Jim Wilson was a throwback, averaging about 50 minutes a game, starting as both an offensive and defensive tackle. He led the team to a Sun Bowl win over Texas Tech and was part of the college all-star team that played the NFL champions Cleveland Browns in what was a traditional game at Soldier Field in Chicago in that era. It was an incredible all-star team that year, featuring such names as Gil Sayers, Dick Butkus, Roger Staubach, Bob Hayes, Fred Blattenkopf, Ralph Neely, and Ken Willard, all of whom became NFL superstars. Largely due to his play in his senior year, he was voted in 1975 to the University of Georgia's all-time team, as well as its all-decade team in the 1960s, and in 2001 was inducted into the Georgia Sports Hall of Fame. Jim Wilson blamed his being inducted in 2001 instead of 25 years earlier on making too many enemies by taking on the wrestling establishment. Dooley once described Jim Wilson as the strongest player I've ever seen, although Wilson, a running back in high school, admitted using Diana Ball to get his size up when the coaching staff at Georgia asked him to convert to the line. Because he had redshirted in college in the NFL and AFL drafts, the leagues at the time were competitive and somewhat at war, this allowed teams to pick players 4 years after they had entered college. He was eligible for the 1964 draft, even though he had a year of eligibility in college left, which meant he was less of a sure thing to sign than a player whose eligibility had ended. He was the 43rd player picked in the NFL draft by the San Francisco 49ers. He was the 109th player picked in the AFL draft by the Boston Patriots. If he didn't sign and went back to college for his senior year, both teams secured what were considered his future rights. He came back for his senior year, and then signed with the 49ers, making the NFL All-Rookie team in 1965 as a 6'3", 258-pound offensive guard, which was a decent size for a lineman in that era. He actually had signed an undated secret contract with the Patriots and collected a bonus before his senior year, which would have made him ineligible. But this was kept secret by both sides. It came out when he announced his signing with the 49ers, and then the Patriots came out publicly to protest hours later, which became a national news story at the time. It could have resulted in the Bulldogs having to forfeit all their wins in 1964 for playing an ineligible player. But since he was not the only player to have done so, it was the pro teams that took the heat instead of the players, who were making no money as college stars. He played two seasons with the 49ers, but sitting on the bench most of 1966, he wanted out. He ended up traded to the Atlanta Falcons, who were a lousy team and just starting out. Jim Wilson had appealed since there was a well-known, since he was well-known as a college star in the state a few years earlier. He spent 1967 loaded on painkillers and missed half the season with back problems, which stemmed from a spinal deformity he suffered from birth. After the season, he was recruited by Ray Gunkel, who ran the wrestling office in Atlanta, who offered him $350 to $400 per week to wrestle during the off season. In those days, NFL players were only paid during the season, and the biggest stars were really making money. Only the ones really making money. Almost all had off-season jobs, and it wasn't unusual for active players to dabble in pro wrestling, as contracts not allowing players to participate in dangerous activities hadn't even been thought of at the time. Jim Wilson's NFL contract was for $25,000 per year, and when he got into wrestling, he noted that the circuit's top stars at the time, the masked Mr. Wrestling, who was Tim Woods, was making double that, which he had a hard time dealing with because his sport was real and wrestling wasn't. Jim Wilson grew up in Pittsburgh, once playing middle school basketball against a team that included Joe Namath of Beaver Falls, and was a closet wrestling fan, and in particular a fan of Bruno Sammartino. Wrestling was different as well. 2 days after being stretched in the dressing room by area shooter Johnny Walker, a talented but aging bald journeyman, stuck in the prelims making $250 a week, who gained fame and superstardom years later as Mr. Wrestling 2. With no training at all, he was put in the ring to learn on the job. During the Augusta Civic Center against an established pro, Louis Tillet, who was to carry the football star, billed as the All-American Kid. He was to be carried to a 20-minute draw in his debut match. But with the crowd noise, Wilson couldn't hear Tillet and wound up holding Tillet in a headlock for almost the entire match, while Tillet would flail around and work the fact that nothing was happening. Ray Gunkel at first was high on Wilson because wrestling promoters in that era loved having real athletes, thinking it gave credibility to the business. Ray Gunkel himself was a champion amateur wrestler and had a reputation as one of the toughest of a tough breed. He told Walker to train Wilson and visualized his two big moves as the old standby for football stars, getting in the three-point stance and exploding with a tackle, similar to today's spear, a move used to football stars in wrestling since Gus Sonnenberg in the late 1920s. He also gave him a submission move, a backbreaker over the shoulder, today called the torture rack or Argentinian backbreaker. Ray Gunkel even called Sam Mushnick at one point, telling him about his background as a legitimate NFL player and throwing Wilson's name in the hat as far as being a future NWA champion. But Falcons management wasn't happy about it. Soon Ray Gunkel had moved Wilson to color commentator, working with Ed Caprell on the Georgia Championship Wrestling Show. Wilson's role as a legitimate athlete was to put over how legitimate the moves and the pain in pro wrestling were. Once when announcing, he made a remark about how the Falcons didn't want him in wrestling and on the air told them if they didn't like it to trade him or he'd go play in Canada. Unlike today in a city like Atlanta, everyone in those days watched the weekly wrestling TV show, and that off-the-cuff remark led him to being traded to the Los Angeles Rams before the start of the 1968 season. George Allen coached the Rams at the time and had no problem with his players wrestling since Don Chuy and Joe Carello had wrestled for years during the offseason and were considered two sports stars. Jim Wilson was a second string offensive tackle on one of the best teams in the league. After the season, he worked in Florida and Georgia, still largely protected because he was a legitimate NFL player and Jack Briscoe took him under his wing. But things started going badly when Fred Ward, a promoter in several Georgia cities, noted both for being a great promoter who had wrestling hot in his cities, most notably Columbus, and being not so great with payoffs, asked him to get color and he refused, saying he doesn't do that. The fact was, both Briscoe and Luthez were known for refusing to get color, but they were already established superstars, and he was a part-timer who wasn't much of a worker and had little going for him except that he was an active NFL player on a great team. Jim Wilson blew out his knee during a preseason game before the 1969 season and had surgery causing him to miss the season, and he never played another NFL game. His knee recovered well enough by January that he went back to wrestling in Georgia and also toured Florida. By then, the top heel in Georgia was Buddy Colt, who didn't like Wilson because he felt he was given too much based on being a football player as opposed to being a good wrestler, and also resenting his refusal to bleed, telling him, "You gotta see red to get the bread." He went back to the Rams for the 1970 season, but suffered another knee injury in the first preseason game. Later that night, he wound up in a fight with some of the Rams players against some Dallas Cowboys players in an after-game party, where he, on crutches, was knocked to the ground and had his knee stomped by members of the Cowboys. He needed another knee operation and was once again out for the season. After a back injury before the 1971 season, the Rams doctors ordered spinal fusion surgery, which in those days meant his career was over. In his book, he described the drug mentality in both wrestling and the NFL as similar, noting the epidemic of pain pills, alcohol, and marijuana in both businesses. He talked openly of people in both professions swallowing pain pills like nothing to play hurt, as neither sport had truly big money and nobody wanted to spend time on the bench. In wrestling, if you didn't play, you most often weren't paid. And in football, while you did get paid while injured, since everyone was hurt, taking time off for most of everything but most of the most severe of injuries was heavily frowned upon. While steroids did exist, they were not nearly as prevalent as they later would be, and this was before the cocaine era. After a long time on the mend from back surgery, he went back to wrestling in 1972 and was given the advice by Jack Briscoe to make his name as a major star. He was going to have to travel to more circuits to get over in more parts of the country. He went to work for Jim Crockett Sr. in the Carolinas. He had a big scar on his back from the surgery. Jim Crockett Sr. came up with the gimmick of bringing him in as the Masked Avenger. The story was that he was an NFL star who Crockett Sr.'s top heel tag team, Gene and Ole Anderson, had beaten up in some imaginary match and caused him to have back surgery, thus ending his football career, and he was there to get revenge on him. He wasn't there long before getting a tour of Japan, where he firsthand saw the Sheik at Farhat and his constant traveling partner and wife, Joyce, getting $5,000 in cash before every match on a one-week tour. Later, in 1973, he was sent on a tour to Australia, which is where he claimed Jim Barnett came on to him and where he rebuffed Barnett. He started doing jobs even against people who were local Australian jobbers. When he returned to Georgia, Bill Watts was the booker, and Watts didn't think highly of Wilson as a performer, labeled him as a clubhouse lawyer. Watts didn't push Wilson, and as the two nearly got into a brawl over it in Columbus, Georgia dressing room, several weeks later, he refused to do a job on a small show in Midgeville, Georgia to a wrestler who was half his size and usually a jobber. A few days later, when booked in Columbus, Fred Ward came up to him and told him, "This is your last night in the wrestling business." Wilson later believed Barnett, who was still in Australia, but actually in a series of maneuvers had already secretly become the controlling partner of the Georgia office, was the reason he was no longer booked strong. Bill Watts, in interviews as well as in his autobiography notes, contradicted that claim, saying that Jim Barnett, who controlled the company but was still living in Australia, didn't interfere with his booking or make any suggestions regarding Wilson. Bill Watts said he didn't book Jim Wilson strong because he thought he was terrible, and those close to Watts note that he was hardly the only person who was going to cover for Jim Barnett, or that Bill Watts was hardly the person who was going to cover for Jim Barnett. I can imagine with what we know about Bill Watts, he probably was not going to cover for Jim Barnett. Dave continues, when Jim Barnett arrived in Georgia, Wilson approached him about work and was turned down. But at the time, there was a promotional war, and he got work with Ann Gunkel's All South Wrestling. But that promotion folded in 1974. Many years later, after his career ended, he sued the NWA and Barnett, believing he had been blacklisted and believing Barnett had destroyed his career and his life. He ended up dropping the suit after a meeting with Barnett about turning the real-life problems covered in the media into an angle. As it turned out, he would be double-crossed there. It was filing a second lawsuit when he thought he hit pay dirt. He and his lawyer called up one person after another in wrestling, but naturally, nobody was going to help him, until he found important allies in Roy Shire and Bob Roop. Shire left the business, bitter, in 1981. He had a very successful run in San Francisco during the 1960s to the mid-1970s, but after a falling out with his company's longtime top star, Pat Patterson, and later losing his prime San Francisco television, KBHK-TV, moved its show from the long-standing 5 p.m. Saturday afternoon time slot to 10 a.m., and Shire never an easy person to get along with, who had several years earlier lost KTVU, at the time one of the most powerful independent stations in the country, because he couldn't get along with management and spit tobacco juices on their office carpets, demanded KBHK give him a better time slot, and he didn't realize he needed more than they needed him, that they needed him more than he needed them, and he lost the station. Good grief, Dave, what a sentence. His territory then fell off. A multimillionaire from wrestling and investing his huge 1960s profits in real estate, he closed down the territory when the spot show started drawing poorly and started losing money. It turned out to be the proverbial snowball rolling downhill, gaining momentum. As crowds fell, payoffs fell, talents were being paid peanuts, except for the Cow Palace shows, and with the quality of talent declining, crowds continued to fall. Roy Shire continued to promote monthly at the Cow Palace, but with less attractive talent. Those crowds started to fall as well. He first made an alliance with Don Owen in Portland, which ended in disaster as Roy Shire and the talent had problems. Plus, Portland ran its big shows taped for television on Saturday nights, and the Cow Palace was a traditional Saturday night stop from the beginning of time. Shire had to move to Friday, which led to decreasing crowds. After falling out with the Portland talent after Buddy Rose cut a promo on Shire's treatment of his talent as a shoot at the Cow Palace, the strange situation saw Shire turn the power off Rose's mic and told fans that pro wrestling was fake. Roy Shire switched to working with Bob Geigel in Kansas City, but their talent in television was terrible. And they were down to a few hundred fans, a 15,000-seat arena. He finally made a deal with Eddie Graham in Florida. Because Graham had Dusty Rhodes and Georgia Championship Wrestling played on cable in much of the Bay Area, and Rhodes was probably the most charismatic wrestler in the business at the time. But at the same time, Vern Gagne reached a deal with Leo Nomolini, an NFL Hall of Famer, who was a cultural icon to at least the older sports writers in Northern California. Vern Gagne had known Nomolini since the late 1940s, as both played football and wrestled at the University of Minnesota before Nomolini became one of the greatest players in the NFL and the area's biggest wrestling star. Even with his stature and history as a big draw, after Shire ran out Joe Malkiewicz, the established NWA promoter, Nomolini, who was Malkiewicz's biggest star, eventually worked for Shire, but Shire was never going to push him, for all the reasons we've seen in similar modern situations. A push Nomolini worked a program in that era against Ray Stevens would have been a license to print money, but Shire wouldn't let Nomolini get past mid-card and eventually retired from wrestling. It was little known that it was Jim Barnett who actually got Roy Shire started as a promoter. Shire and Carl Ray Stevens, as the Shire brothers, were Barnett's top tag team in his promotion and the largest in the country during the late 1950s. A Chevrolet dealer whom Jim Barnett knew in San Francisco, which already was having huge success on Sunday nights in primetime with Bay Bombers Roller Derby. They agreed to do a two-hour live program in prime time on Friday nights using roller derby announcer Walt Harris as host. The television show became an instant sensation. Roy Shire installed his brother Stevens, his quote brother Stevens, who some considered the single best performer in the business at the time, as the top heel who became a huge draw. Barnett already had a huge full plate, and felt that Shire had become something of a wrestling genius as Shire studied promoting and booking while being a wrestler. Jim Barnett set Shire up in exchange for a piece of the action. In fact, most of Shire's early stars were talent sent originally from Barnett's Indianapolis office. Malkiewicz was the established NWA promoter since the start of the alliance. Neither Jim Barnett nor Roy Shire were NWA members in the early years, but Shire in 1968 and Barnett in 1969 both ended up joining the alliance during the 1970s, each becoming major power brokers. If you're wondering when we're going to get back to Jim Barnett, well, we're going through the history of San Francisco wrestling basically to get to this second lawsuit that Jim Barnett's filed. In the late 1980s, Roy Shire was furious that Vern Gagne, through Nomolini's name and connections, got on TV on KTVU and started promoting that they would start running in the area, and then announced a January Battle Royal at the Oakland Coliseum Arena, earlier in the same month as Shire's traditional biggest show of the year, the January Cal Palace Battle Royal. Worse for him, Vern Gagne featured interviews on his show with Pat Patterson and Ray Stevens regularly, and promoted Shire's two biggest stars of the prior 20 years in Northern California as being part of the AWA coming into the Bay Area, along with constantly promoting one of the area's all-time sports legends and first huge wrestling draw as the promoter. Shire called Barnett, who by this point was the real power of the NWA. Barnett was never NWA president because he was gay, but was given that role as either secretary treasurer or vice president. In the former, he controlled the money, and from 1975 to 1982, Jim Barnett booked the world champion after he agreed to do it for free after Sam Muchnick quit as president in 1975. Sam Muchnick was set up to quit by promoters who didn't like Muchnick dictating the terms of always keeping the champion strong, wanting the champion to ultimately win his programs and limit screwjob finishes, not to mention Muchnick getting 3% of the gate in all title matches as a booking fee. Roy Shire called Barnett to ask him why Vern Gagne was coming into his territory and to tell him to stay out. Jim Barnett recounted to me years ago how he called Vern Gagne up and nicely asked him to stay out of Roy Shire's territory. Vern Gagne told him, no, there's nothing else I could do but tell Roy. The irony, of course, is that Vern Gagne did nothing different than what Barnett and Shire did 20 years earlier, and it was only a few years later that Gagne was the one protesting how Vince McMahon broke the code when he started running in Gagne's territory. Roy Shire was furious that the NWA wouldn't protect his territory, and rather than engage in a fight that would cost him money against a promoter who had a strong stable, including Stevens and Patterson, and a healthy circuit, Shire closed down his operations and was bitter at everyone in wrestling. When Jim Wilson's lawyer called, they found what they were looking for. Whether true or not, Roy Shire claimed he was told by phone in the 1970s that Jim Wilson was on the NWA blacklist. He claimed he got a call from Mike LaBelle, who by that time Roy Shire hated, who told him that Jim Wilson was a troublemaker, refused to lose when asked, and was always complaining about his payoffs and that nobody should use him. Shire testified about how blacklisting worked and then, under oath, said he had also heard Jim Barnett was miffed because Jim Wilson turned down his homosexual advances, and said specifically that Eddie Graham had wanted to use Jim Wilson, but Barnett told him not to and he wouldn't. Then he claimed that there was a blonde wrestler who went along with Barnett's advances, and Barnett made him a superstar. Roy Shire was just getting out of the business when Tommy Rich was becoming a national superstar from his exposure on Georgia Championship Wrestling. When asked who, Shire was so disconnected that he didn't know, saying, "Richie, a blonde wrestler, somebody Richie." In actuality, the young Tommy Rich had tremendous charisma and appeal at a time before drugs and alcohol destroyed it. He became a superstar at such a young age on a national basis, although he had already been a star on the Tennessee circuit, that there were jealous rumors that had started, as there was always be in wrestling involving a good-looking pretty boy getting a push from a gay promoter. Sometimes in wrestling, those rumors are true, and often they were not. Given Rich's ability to get over and draw in that time frame, because Rich got a one-week run as NWA champion in 1981 when he was only 24 years old in the Georgia territory, most of Georgia at the time thought it was most likely just jealousy that made up the story. But at that point, Tommy Rich hadn't been a star for very long, and to get the NWA title even for a week was something few wrestlers would ever get close to. Dusty Rhodes got a one-week run, but he was far more established as a superstar. Tommy Rich was a superstar in Georgia, but the power of the superstation made him a name everywhere that a cable company carried the station. His title win paid off a long-built-up storyline, but unless you lived and followed that circuit, Rich was not someone most in the business would think would even get a small taste of the world title. Roy Shire was out of the business by that time, but he was bitter at the nature of his exit and was more than willing to repeat the story under oath. It greatly helped Jim Wilson's case, since Roy Shire was a former member of the NWA Board of Directors, giving him courtroom credibility. Under oath, Roy Shire even said that the NWA felt it would be bad for its image for Barnett to be NWA president, although privately they all thought he would have made a great president. At another point, when Wilson and his usual partner at the time, Thunderbolt Patterson, were about to promote an Omni show in opposition to Jim Barnett, Bob Roop, a heavyweight on the 1968 U.S. Olympic team in Greco-Roman wrestling, said he was brought to Atlanta. He claimed shortly after arrival, he was asked in the dressing room by Barnett, in front of all the talent, to put pressure on him if he thought he could beat up Thunderbolt Patterson and put him out of the business. Roop said it was a moot point because he liked Patterson. Roop said 2 weeks later, Barnett went up to him and said he didn't even know what he was doing in the territory. Wilson and Patterson would on occasion attend Georgia wrestling shows, sometimes picketing and always looking to garner attention. Barnett once even told me that as much as he didn't like Wilson and had his own version of Wilson's problems in Australia having to do with an affair with a stewardess and with his airline sponsor that got sorted, a charge Wilson always denied, which meant he didn't want to risk pushing him, that all the attention Wilson and Patterson had gotten with the fans as opposition could have been big business. Even though Barnett felt Wilson was not particularly charismatic and boring as a wrestler, and the last thing he wanted was him picketing at the shows, he felt that an outsider angle with Wilson and Hardy Race, the world champion at the time, would have drawn a sellout, and he at one point was up for doing it. But he said Booker Ole Anderson was dead set against it, so it never went anywhere. Bob Roop testified that once at a show in Atlanta, Leon Ogle, the son-in-law of Fred Ward, saw where Wilson was in the crowd getting attention. He wanted Bob Roop to beg Wilson to get in the ring, put him in a position where he couldn't refuse without looking weak to the crowd, and then to hurt him. But Bob Roop said he refused to do it. Bob Roop in his younger days worked as a hitman for Eddie Graham, as did Jack Briscoe and Hiro Matsuda, but he never had the killer instinct as a fighter and hated doing it. Bob Roop was groomed at one point to be world champion, but promoters, having an Olympic wrestler at that time, wanted to use him as a shooter, whether to challenge fans, beat up people who wanted to get in the profession, or to keep the boys in line. But Roop never liked doing it. He was quickly branded as a talented wrestler, but they started whispering that he had no guts. Jim Wilson ended up losing the family home after refinancing it to run an opposition promotion, and it wound up costing him his marriage. After he filed his first lawsuit against the NWA, claiming to be blacklisted, this was before he had the key testimony from Roy Shire, he started picketing in front of the Friday night shows in Atlanta and got some area news coverage for his gripes about being blacklisted. By this point, he was more than a minor annoyance to Jim Barnett. This time, Barnett called Wilson up in 1977. Wilson and Barnett talked over the big angle. This would be the period Barnett believed Jim Wilson had got so much attention that even with his shortcomings, he could draw him a big house doing the outsider gimmick. Barnett sensed, because of all the publicity, that even the majority of people who thought wrestling wasn't real would believe in Wilson. After all his public protest, he would not agree to lose a match to Hardy Race, and it would have a reality that would result in hot ticket sales. Hardy Race and Jim Wilson had plenty of problems earlier, nearly getting into it in a few parking lot situations when Jim Wilson would go to NWA shows around the state and pass out flyers to his opposition shows. Hardy Race had a reputation as a fighter, and as a person was believed to be fearless. Perhaps Jim Barnett was thinking business, although it also is conceivable he was thinking he could kill two birds with one stone, both getting the business for one big show and then having Wilson humbled, shut up, and have the business protected at the same time. Jim Wilson sent Barnett, asked him what it would take for him to drop the lawsuit, and Wilson said he wanted a full-time main event position in the promotion, as well as the ability to promote Towns on his own. Then Wilson suggested what Barnett had himself was thinking, only bigger. He wanted a title match with Race at Fulton County Stadium in Atlanta. Barnett said he really thought Race versus Wilson for a one-shot could have possibly sold out the Omni, but thought the suggestion of running the baseball stadium was too much of a reach. Jim Barnett noted they had only sold out the Omni a few times, and the business at the time was down. Barnett agreed to the match at the Omni, but that he would agree to use Wilson on top after the match. And with his credibility in media as a straight shooter on wrestling problems and his legit background, he thought with his connections, he could get Wilson a weekly column at the Atlanta Constitution covering wrestling, which would give the promotion another key avenue in getting publicity. However, Jim Barnett said he didn't want to run the angle until early 1978, but he would get him work in other territories until that time, and didn't want their agreement put in writing because he didn't want it known that he was capitulated to Wilson. Jim Barnett told him to drop the lawsuit and give him a few months for all the heat to die down, and they'd do the program. Jim Wilson didn't realize the con. Giving time for the heat to die down would counteract the unique situation the heat had inadvertently created. Jim Wilson at first said he would think about the offer and did not drop the suit. At the same time, Jim Wilson was fired from his regular job at a real estate firm, which, like so many of his problems, he believes was the ultra-connected Jim Barnett's maneuverings. Barnett did claim to have power everywhere and most certainly had connections, but whether or not this is was in his reach is impossible to say. With no job, Jim Wilson could no longer pay lawyers to keep his suit going, felt pressured to accept Barnett's offer, and dropped the suit, even without consulting his own attorney. When the first of the year came, Jim Wilson called Ole Anderson, Barnett's booker, and suddenly everything they had talked about had been forgotten, and of course, it wasn't in writing. Anderson claimed he had the territory booked for the next year and had no openings. Jim Wilson called Barnett every week until April, when Barnett told Wilson to stop pestering him. And when Wilson talked about their agreement, Jim Barnett told him that if he didn't like it, sue me. Barnett figured Wilson was, at this point, broke, had lost his home and his marriage and his job. In late 1978, Jim Wilson sued Barnett and the NWA for $4 million, claiming $2 million in actual damages and $2 million in punitive damages. His case got credence when, at the same time, the Poffo family, Angelo, Randy, that's Randy Savage, and Lanny, sued 9 NWA promotions and 13 promoters, claiming restraint of trade as they tried to block talent from working for the family's ICW, which was running opposition to the NWA. Ann Gunkel had also sued Georgia Championship Wrestling, claiming illegal monopolistic tactics were used in putting her company out of business. The Poffos ended up with their own powerful ally, the Sheik, whose own big-time wrestling promotion collapsed as the Sheik's once great drawing magic had ended. The Sheik killed the territory with advertising huge names and then often not delivering, burning out the promotion on short, bloody matches and repetitive gimmicks, and staying too long on top after, for many years, being one of the two greatest heel draws up to that point in the business. With nobody running Michigan and Ohio, Barnett expanded Georgia Championship Wrestling in those markets and was doing big business, and the Sheik wasn't cut in. Later, the Sheik worked a show Jim Wilson and Thunderbolt Patterson promoted at the Omni, billed as World Heavyweight Champion, dropping the title in the main event to Thunderbolt Patterson, who was to be billed as the first black world champion. Except the debut show didn't do well and the promotion was done. At the 1981 NWA convention, the Sheik was kicked out of the alliance for 1 year for violating rules by participating in a match billed for the World Heavyweight title, as promoters were not allowed to bill anyone as World Heavyweight Champion except the NWA World Champion, nor participate in matches. Of course, during the same era, the WWF and AWA champions often appeared on NWA shows, violating those same bylaws with no repercussions. Barnett and Georgia Championship Wrestling settled out of court with Gunkel in 1980 for $200,000. Gunkel then tried to get back into promoting wrestling, trying to run her on her own at first, and later worked with Joe Blanchard and even with Ole Anderson, but it was short-lived. The Poffo suit died in 1982 when Bob Roop and Barnes recanted their prior testimony, and nobody's surprise got jobs with the NWA promotions, ending their outlaw status. The ICW made amends with Jarrett Promotions, and the shoot angle from the promotion feud with Jerry Lawler versus Randy Savage did big short-term business. And while working in Tennessee, someone from WWF discovered Randy Savage's phenomenal work, and he was brought in and became one of the biggest stars of the 1980s from the most mainstream of promotions. Jim Wilson's lawsuit finally went to trial in 1985. But by that point in time, Jim Barnett had been kicked out of power in Georgia Championship Wrestling and was broke. Like everyone in wrestling, Jim Barnett was assumed to be a multimillionaire, and while he was paid handsomely as head of the Georgia promotion, he lived a lavish lifestyle using his salary and company funds. He always wore expensive suits and ties, ate at the nicest restaurants, bought his influence with lavish gifts to local politicians, TV station managers, area managers, and almost anyone else who could help him. He would go around Georgia in a chauffeur-driven Rolls Royce, purchase two expensive condos next to each other, and knock the wall out to make one extravagant unit. He had a personal maid, a personal driver, a personal chef. He would fly to New York and catch the plays on Broadway. And when Jimmy Carter, whose family was an avid wrestling fans in Georgia, was the president, Jimmy Carter picked Barnett for a position as National Council for the Arts. In 1972, Jim Barnett attended Richard Nixon's second-term inauguration with a fourth-row seat. Seated in the rows behind him were Bob Hope and John Wayne. That was fine in the 1970s when the company was making $2 million per year in profit, leaving all the stockholders with nice dividends, even with Barnett's lavish spending. But in the 1980s, when bad booking and marketing changes led to the company going deeply in the red, Booker Ole Anderson started investigating and found out how much company money Barnett was using to live his lifestyle, which included a monthly phone bill alone that regularly exceeded $2,000. Ole Anderson alerted other stockholders, then told Barnett on Christmas Day of 1982 what he found and threatened to charge him with embezzlement unless Barnett agreed to resign. Barnett agreed, but begged that even in lieu of a salary, he asked if he could keep a paper executive title for his own public appearance. Ole Anderson said, "You're out with no concessions," or he would go to the authorities. Jim Barnett was taking all the money and wasn't paying the stockholders, said Jack Briscoe, who owned a percentage of the promotion. Fred Ward was really upset. "It was a revolt from the stockholders, including myself. We all had a meeting and voted amongst ourselves who we wanted to run things. We voted Jim out and voted Ole in. Jim then sold his stock, 18%, to Jim Oates, who had bankrolled Barnett's wrestling companies for decades since the two of them met in college working on the school newspaper at the University of Chicago for $180,000 and got out. We, being Jim Oates and Jim Barnett, had the most stock, but we didn't have 51% and I wasn't able to save him," said Oates. Barnett got revenge of sorts as in 1983 he'd been hired by the World Wrestling Federation, and at the NWA meeting, he, Vince McMahon Sr., Vince McMahon Jr. all tendered their resignations from the Alliance, the precursor of the biggest wrestling promotional war up to that point in history. Oates and Barnett both claimed they had nothing to do with the sale of Georgia Championship Wrestling to McMahon in early 1984 and were only stockholders who were part of the majority consortium when Jack and Jerry Briscoe orchestrated the deal. Oates at the time owned 26% of the company. Jack and Jerry together owned 19%, and the Briscoes had to convince Frances Jones, the wife of longtime Atlanta promoter Paul Jones, who was senile by that time, to pledge her 22% so they had a majority of stock to sell controlling interest in the company to McMahon. The Briscoes carried the deal to Barnett, who was McMahon's number two guy in the company at the time. The Briscoes were worried about the future of the company, believing McMahon was going to win the wrestling war in the end, and in return, Vince McMahon and Jim Barnett promised the two would be taken care of for life, although Jack quit the business just a few months later and never looked back. Ole Anderson, although he was running the company, had no idea there were negotiations going on for a sale, let alone that the sale itself had been completed until after the contracts were signed and McMahon owned the company, giving him for 1 year control of the key wrestling time slots on Saturdays and Sundays on TBS. At the time of the trial, Georgia Championship Wrestling was owned by McMahon, although essentially no longer in existence. Jim Barnett was a major power player as director of operations for WWF, a position he held for several years during the company's expansion, where his connections with TV people all over the U.S. dating back to the 1950s came in handy. He used to brag about giving Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant both $750,000 checks as their payoffs for WrestleMania III. Although, as usually happens in wrestling, as the years went on, those figures started to increase significantly. Even if Jim Wilson won the suit, Jim Barnett had no liquid assets, and Georgia Championship Wrestling as a company was all but gone. If the McMahons were made liable for an award against the company they now owned, they would appeal, and Wilson realized he didn't have the money to fight against the McMahons in court. Roy Shire was there and ready to testify. Against the advice of his attorney, Jim Wilson took a relatively small settlement offer. In his book, he only stated he was not allowed to give the amount, but it was less than $100,000. At the time, media reports indicated the settlement was closer to $20,000 to $25,000, described because while in settlement talks before the trial started, they found that Jim Barnett was not the multimillionaire they believed he was and was actually almost completely broke. Thunderbolt Patterson had ended up settling by being offered a job by Jim Crockett for $100,000 per year to come back as a headline wrestler. Thunderbolt Patterson was given a push for the terms of the contract, teaming with and later feuding with Ole Anderson. When the contract expired, it was not renewed, and his career was pretty much over. Jim Wilson appeared on ABC TV's 2020 in its expose on pro wrestling in 1985, best known for David Schultz slapping reporter John Stossel twice hard in the ear, knocking him down in one of the more memorable television moments of the time. Jim Wilson was portrayed as a promising star who was blacklisted for not accepting the advances of a gay promoter who was not named. But the piece was weakened because Stossel believed the big impact of the story was uncovering that pro wrestling was fake, as opposed to dealing with the very real issues behind the scenes. Jim Wilson also appeared on a talk show with Eddie Mansfield, trying to use pro wrestling promo style to raise money, hawking Save the Wrestlers t-shirts, which came across poorly. Wilson and Mansfield ended up debating, of all people, Lou Thesz. It was a sad display on all parts. Wilson and Mansfield claimed that wrestling wasn't real, and Thesz was there to defend the undefendable. Thesz portrayed both as mediocre talents who hadn't learned their wrestling, and at one point, the 69-year-old Thesz challenged both to a real wrestling match. Even at that age, Thesz's reputation was such that both men incensed back down, and Mansfield talking about he didn't want to go in there with shooter Lou Thesz, but eventually it was Thesz who stormed off the set in the middle of the show. A few years later, Jim Wilson was in a sad scene with Thunderbolt Patterson trying to be serious about wrestling's problems on the embarrassing but at the same time highly popular Morton Downey Jr. show. Representing wrestling, among others, was David Schultz, by that time largely out of the wrestling business, after being fired by the WWF for trying to attack Mr. T in Los Angeles for real a few months before WrestleMania, where Mr. T was a key figure in what appeared to be WWF's make-or-break show. Everyone came off badly in the cartoon-like atmosphere, which included Downey Jr. When Wilson told of his career dying after turning down the advances of a gay promoter, saying to Wilson incredulously, "You're not that good looking." Schultz tried to verbally and physically intimidate Wilson, standing up and challenging him to a fight on the spot. Wilson would not stand up, avoided eye contact from the apparent raging lunatic, giving the impression he was backing down. Jim Wilson's name rarely surfaced after that point, doing some interviews where his book came out. and others in 2007 after the death of Chris Benoit, this time pushing in interviews that Congress should investigate a business that led to so many people dying young. By 1988, the NWA, as it was in the 1970s, was largely dead, and almost all the big power brokers of that era were gone. Eddie Graham committed suicide in 1985. Jim Barnett attempted suicide after being fired by McMahon, but ended up working for Crockett and then Turner on and off. Eric Bischoff, who had no use for him, was able to get rid of him at one point until the death of the company in 2001, but he was no longer wielding any significant influence. After WCW folded, with Barnett broke, McMahon hired him as a consultant, a decision more of an act of kindness than business to a man who did help build his company and who worked closely with his father. Jim Barnett, mainly in phone calls to McMahon, constantly pushed that the company should make John Cena a big star because he saw Cena as having something special that he didn't see in anyone else on the roster. Cena was brought up too early from Ohio Valley Wrestling by Paul Heyman, SmackDown's Booker, who saw in his promos and his look that he could be a superstar, and figured his positives, and with protective booking, could overcome his limitations in the ring. But after a strong debut angle, Heyman's idea to immediately break Cena apart from the pack by coming up with an angle where he would slap Vince McMahon in the face when McMahon would try to humble him was said to be stupid and not believable by Triple H and Nixed. Other angles to do something with him ended up canceled, and he politically was unable to be protected. Cena was floundering, working as a jobber on B shows, and was on the verge of being fired. Barnett would constantly bring up that Cena should be pushed as a superstar, and also that he needed to get regular ring gear and should ditch the throwback jerseys. There have all been those who credit Barnett's constant bringing up of Cena as a future superstar for saving his job, although that may or may not be true. Although Barnett had nothing to do with his getting the push with the rapper gimmick that saved his career. Jim Barnett had wanted to do an autobiography in 2000, noting that with the death of Sam Mushnick, he was the last person who could truly tell the history behind the scenes of the growth and the ups and downs of the industry from its beginnings on television in the late 1940s to the present, but it never happened. He was secretly battling cancer for several years and passed away on September 17, 2004, at the age of 80. In his book, Jim Wilson's thoughts on spending so much of his adult life fighting an unwinnable battle of a now completely different business with different issues and a different structure, concluded by saying the most important lesson of the 1990s was, tell them it's fake and nobody will care about other deceptions. Tell them it's not competition and nobody will care about the injuries and death. Tell them they're independent contractors responsible for their own bodies and dead wrestlers will get little sympathy. And tell them it's all sports entertainment and they'll let anything go. That is a hugely detailed biography for somebody who literally was a minor footnote in the history of professional wrestling. But it is very, I think, very fascinating, all the different stuff that Jim Wilson was intertwined with to be such a minor name in the overall scheme of things. And like I said, I had the opportunity to interview Jim Wilson when his book came out, but I dealt with him and Johnson for about 10 minutes of my life, and that was about 10 minutes too much. So I don't know what that means or how that all shakes out, but quite the history lesson there, many different directions intertwined into the life and death of one Jim Wilson. What a fascinating, bizarre story. So this has been from the pages of the Wrestling Observer Newsletter. I am Carl Stern. Thanks a lot for joining me. Hope you'll check out my website, whenitwascool.com. Now, Jim Wilson is nowhere on our list of the 201 greatest pro wrestlers of all time, but I hope you'll check that list out. It is an aggregated list where I've taken over 30 sources, their list of the top wrestlers of all time, average them together to come out with a consensus view of who the 201 greatest pro wrestlers of all time are. In that article, I'm embedding podcast biographies to many of the entrants on that list, so I hope you'll check that out. Go to whenitwascool.com, and ultimately, I hope if you like our free stuff enough, that you will decide to support us on Patreon, where over 2,000 podcasts await you dealing with pro wrestling history, pop culture, retro pop culture, and much, much more. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you here again soon with another show.
If you liked what you heard, go to whenitwascool.com.
This is the sound of the 80s. Everybody's looking for it, and we've got it.
And hit that Patreon button.
If you'll excuse me, I need to go buy a new Cyndi Lauper CD and have myself a little cry.